From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, satirizing the news, we talk with Scott Dickers, editor of The Onion, the mock newspaper with satirical headlines and articles. The best-selling book version, Our Dumb Century, features mock newspaper front pages from throughout the 20th century. Also, satirical songs, written and performed by Loudon Wainwright III. His new CD is a collection of topical songs on subjects ranging from the Clintons to Y2K. Several of these songs were first performed on NPR's Morning Edition. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Investigators are giving a few more details on the last moments of John F. Kennedy Jr.'s flight into the Atlantic. NPR's Marianne Akers reports from Cape Cod.
Kennedy's plane apparently nosedived into the waters off Cape Cod. Investigators say the plane was at 5,600 feet, about 34 miles from Martha's Vineyard, where Kennedy, his wife, and sister-in-law were due to land. The plane started to descend at a rate of 700 feet per minute. It continued for 5 minutes at an airspeed of 160 knots. Then the plane turned to the right and climbed back up 300 feet. It remained there only 1 minute before it plunged toward the ocean. Search teams are continuing their work overnight to find bodies and more wreckage from Kennedy's Piper Saratoga. Search officials say the work is laborious. Divers have visibility of only about 8 feet and are searching at 115 feet below the surface. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Former U.S. Senator George Mitchell has been named to lead a review of the Northern Ireland peace process following the latest failure to form a new government for the province. Prime Minister Tony Blair said today that Britain and Ireland will oversee the review as Mitchell meets with the leaders of the various parties in the peace process. Tonight, Mitchell was scheduled to talk with David Trimble, the head of the Protestant Ulster Unionist Party. After discussions with the other party leaders, Prime Minister Blair said the talks will be adjourned for the summer and will resume again in the fall. The most difficult issue so far has been the problem of getting guerrilla groups to give up their weapons. People in north-central Iowa are trying to clean up from flash floods, but the weather forecast is threatening more heavy rain. Pat Blank reports from member station KUNI in Cedar Falls, Iowa.
Nearly 10 inches of rain fell in just 4 hours, washing away roads and forcing the evacuation of homes and a campground. Governor Tom Vilsack has declared 4 Iowa counties disaster areas. That means help is on the way. Pebble Holland is with the State Emergency Management Agency.
The Department of Transportation can assist as far as providing barricades for road closings. Public safety, the same thing as far as making sure that folks don't go down roads that have water on them. We also have individuals from the Department of Human Services and the American Red Cross and Elder Affairs that are also part of our emergency response group here at the State Emergency Operations Center.
Meantime, the forecast includes a flash flood watch through tomorrow. For NPR News, this is Pat Blank in Cedar Falls, Iowa.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 191 points to close at 10,996. Declining issues led advances by 5-2 in active trading of 752 million shares. This is NPR. A former member of the 1970s group, the Symbionese Liberation Army, has been ordered released on $1 million bail. Kathleen Solia faces charges in Los Angeles dating to 1975. Steve Futterman reports from Los Angeles.
Kathleen Solia appeared in court just briefly, long enough for her lawyers to show that she has raised the necessary funds. The judge then approved her release. As required by the court, Solia will be monitored electronically. Afterwards, one of her attorneys, Stuart Hanlon, insisted no plea bargain is being worked on.
There is no evidence linking her to this crime. There's no reason to have an innocent client plead guilty when there's no evidence. The reason there's no evidence is that she's not involved in the crime.
Kathleen Solia is accused of planting pipe bombs under 2 Los Angeles police cars. The bombs never went off. Solia was a fugitive for more than 20 years. Most of that time, she lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, using the name Sarah Jane Olson. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman, in Los Angeles.
The Commerce Department warned today that the U.S. may take action against Japan and five other countries for allegedly dumping their steel plate in the U.S. market. If the accusations are found to be true, the federal government could impose punitive tariffs of as much as 59% on the offending steel products. The government said today that some steel producers in Japan, South Korea, India, France, Indonesia, and Italy may be selling their steel plate in the U.S. for less than it costs to produce or less than it sells for in its home markets. The decision was the third victory in 2 days for the U.S. steel industry, which says it has been severely hurt by unfairly priced foreign steel. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've probably heard of The Onion by now, the mock newspaper that was described by Hendrik Hertzberg in The New Yorker as the country's most interesting satiric publication, a more cogent running critique of the assumptions of mainstream journalism than any review of media studies. The Onion is published in newspaper form, complete with mock headlines, articles, editorials, Wall Street News, weather reports, and advice columns. It's also published on the web. My guest, Scott Dickers, is the editor of The Onion and the best-selling book version, Our Dumb Century, which features mock newspaper front pages spanning the 20th century. Today is the 30th anniversary of the day the Apollo 11 astronauts landed on the moon. From the audiobook version of Our Dumb Century, here's the radio communication between the astronauts on the moon's Tranquility Base and NASA personnel at Mission Control.
This is Tranquility Base. The Eagle has landed. Jesus H. Christ, Houston. We're on the f***ing moon. Over.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy that. We cannot believe you are on the f***ing moon. Repeat, cannot f***ing believe it. Over.
On the bottom rung of the ladder. Just one more step and I absolutely am standing on the surface of the f***ing moon. I'm talking to you from the surface of the f***ing moon. Jesus H. Christ in a chicken basket.
Scott Dickers first joined the staff of The Onion as a cartoonist. He's been the editor for the past 9 years. I asked him if The Onion has gone through different phases over the years.
Yeah, it was a slow evolution. It started out as a college humor publication, and it was pretty wacky. We had wacky contests, and we would pull silly pranks and stuff like that. And over the years, we sort of found our voice, and I think it was because we were printed on newsprint that we decided, you know, what we should really do is be a parody of a newspaper. And that was about 1996. We kind of revamped it and really decided to hone in on that idea that this is, okay, now we're going to pretend like we're a daily newspaper and all the humor kind of has to be funneled through that format. And we went online with that concept as well about the same time when CNN and some of the other big news organizations were going online. And so we just modeled our website after theirs. And that was a really interesting experiment because then people started seeing The Onion as a real news source, which I loved because I think that helps the humor. When the first time you see it, you're thinking, oh, it's the newspaper. I'll just sit down here and read some news. And then you go, wait a minute, something's gone terribly wrong with the world, which, of course, is what we're trying to say, I guess.
One of the things I really like about the book The Onion is that you take on the whole century. Did you have to go back and do a lot of research about the look and the language of early newspapers? You know, I mean, of newspapers at the first part of the 20th century.
Surprisingly, not a lot. A lot of us are kind of history buffs, and there's a couple of the writers on staff who just have a knack for that turn of the century news writing. Don't ask me why. I kind of have a knack for news writing around the World War II era. But obviously we did eventually have to look up some stuff, and especially the designers to get the look just right. There was one story, actually, that I researched to do a story about. We had this story in the 60s. It was the Russian space program ahead of U.S. in dog-killing race. And I looked up the story in the paper from 1960, and it talked about how news from Russia was that the Russians had sent Laika, the first Russian dog, into space. And after, you know, a few hours, he came down and Khrushchev patted him on the head and everything was great. And then I did some research on the NASA website to do our version of the story. Turns out the dog died in space. He was up there for 10 days, you know, his face frozen in terror. He's starving in a 1 foot, you know, chamber. And that kind of made me realize, wow, you know, we're actually... maybe we're doing more than just a humor book here. We're doing a service by maybe pointing out some of the absurdities of newspapers. Because you read the newspaper today, you don't know how much of that is true, you know? And that's kind of our whole point with the parody of newspapers is who's to say what's true, who's to say what's news. And maybe our version of the news, as whacked out as it is as valid as anyone else's.
Let me ask you to read the headlines from the first front page paper in Our Dumb Century.
Yeah, this is from January 1, 1900. A new century dawns. McKinley ushers in bold new coal age. As new epic dawns, our president hails future, comma, coal. Complete text of brief three-hour address on pages 4 through 7. Death by corset rates stabilize at 1 in 6. Growing use of Dr. Scheidt's patented safety corset. Ladies breathe slightly less painful sigh of relief. Then there's news from Rome. Vatican condemns rhythm method. Pontiff excoriates infidels for fiendish sin by the calendar. Releases papal edict outlining forbidden family practices. Italians in attendance vow to people the earth.
Scott, how did you decide what stories to put on your first front page in the book?
Well, we kind of had to use our memories first and say, okay, what are some things we remember from the first decade of the century? And, you know, you come up with a short list of maybe two or three things. McKinley's assassinated, the San Francisco earthquake, first flight, that sort of stuff. So we kind of started with those. We figured, well, if we can think of stuff like that, that's probably what most people think of as the big stories. So those kind of became our front page headlines, the big, you know, top of the page stuff. And then we kind of used our idea about the character of the time and came up with some wacky stuff, which I guess is where a story like the corset, death by corset rates comes in. That's just us making fun of, you know, what we imagine to be some horrible things happening then. And then as our last resort, we get these books out, like these timetables of history books. And you look at some of the events and you say, you know, oh, the Boer War was ending about that time. So let's do something about that, you know, and that's kind of how you fill out the little spaces.
Now, I love the language that you use in some of the headlines, like in one of the headlines from the child labor era. The headline is, United States leads world in industry. Thanks, orphans, grateful Americans say. And, of course, there's a big exclamation point after thanks, orphans. And yeah. I know a lot of the newsreels later on had that kind of patriotic, optimistic exclamation point kind of language. Did the newspaper right. headlines have that, too?
I think we made that up. The newspaper headlines, well, actually, no, I take that back. They weren't as obvious about it as we are. But, you know, we thought it would be funny to quote in our stories, you know, leading industrialists say, you know, and really, you know, prop up evil capitalist industrialists who are basically torturing orphan children at work all day as these models of society. And we thought that was funny. And then in the 30s, we have a story where they... after a few years of the Depression have gone by, there's an article that says evil, bloated plutocrats losing favor with some Americans. Like, we're all shocked at how that could be happening. And that voice, that patriotic voice, kind of wanes in the 70s, and then it sort of comes back in the 80s.
Well, actually, I really particularly like that evil, bloated plutocrats headline. Let me read the whole thing for our listeners. This is from 1932 in The Onion. Evil, bloated plutocrats losing favor with some Americans, some workers losing faith in goodwill of oppressors, long-renowned steel magnates, railroad tycoons, puzzled by waning popularity. What I particularly like about that is that you've taken the, monopoly era, the era of magnates and monopolies, and... put it into the language of today's popularity polls, where everything is about popularity.
That was one thing that was really fun about doing this book. We got to do certain types of humor that we simply couldn't do in the Onion newspaper every week, which is take things that people know of today and transfer them back to then. Yeah, like the idea of popularity of a certain group being important. It's really fun to apply that to things in the 30s. And obviously another type of humor we could do is you know, go back with knowledge of the future, which we can't do now, which is a lot of fun.
There's a good example of that. Let me ask you to read it. And this is about television. And you have an article about, you know, the new arrival of television. Would you read the headline and a little bit of the story for us, Scott?
Yeah, it's "Television Promises Mass Enrichment of Mankind. Drama and Learning Box Will Make Schools Obsolete by 1970. New device to provide high-minded alternative to mindless drivel found on radio. Imagine, if you will, touring the ancient ruins of the Roman Empire, watching a demonstration on the fine art of sculpture, or having the theories of velocity explained to you by a doctor of physics, all in the comfort of your own den after supper."
That's really funny. There's something else I want to read, and this is along the lines of what we're talking about. It's an advertisement in one of your 1928 editions, but it's about a concept that only exists today. And so the ad reads, "Gents, dial the following telephone number to listen to unmarried young ladies converse in a most suggestive and stimulating manner." So it's like your 1928 phone sex ad.
Right.
How'd you come up with that idea? Do you remember?
I think that stemmed a little bit from an idea we actually ran in the Onion newspaper, which was Senator Strom Thurmond drafts bill prohibiting telegraph porn. And so it was only a small step from there to think, oh, how about we do a funny, you know, phone sex ad from 1928?
My guest is Scott Diggers, and he's the editor of the weekly social satire publication The Onion, which is written in the form of a newspaper. The Onion also has a new bestseller called Our Dumb Century. Scott, why don't we take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Diggers, editor of the weekly social satire The Onion. Here's another news story from the audio version of The Onion book, Our Dumb Century.
It's The Onion Radio News. I'm Doyle Redland. Media mogul Rupert Murdoch announced Friday he will launch Fox, a new television network he projects will employ over 25,000 Wayans brothers by 1995. The network will soon be offering programs including The Kenan Ivory Wayans Show, Damon and Friends, Wayans and Company, The Wayans Brothers Hip Hop Variety Hour, Wayans in the House, It's Wayans Time, Name That Wayans, My Brother the Wayans, Live with Wayans and Wayans, and She's a Wayans, starring Wayans' sister Kim Wayans as an actress struggling to make it in a male Wayans-dominated world. Here's what writer...
That's a reading from the audiobook version of Our Dumb Century, which is a century worth of social satire from The Onion. And The Onion is a satire of newspaper articles and headlines. My guest is the editor, Scott Diggers. What was the era that was easiest for you to do, that you really felt like, I get it, you know?
The 60s.
Why?
There's such upheaval. There's so much to make fun of. You can make fun of stuffy authority figures, dirty hippies. There's really just the moon landing. I mean, all that stuff is just so funny. And, you know, believe it or not, the public is actually clamoring for more jokes about... the moon landing. No, they're not really. That was one thing we thought was, you know, they said, oh, so The Onion's doing a book. Wait a minute, you're going to have a bunch of William McKinley jokes? I don't really think that's what the public wants. I disagree. I think William McKinley is funny.
I want you to read some headlines from, this is like a late 1949 edition of The Onion, and it's basically heralding the pop culture to come of the early 1950s.
Yeah, this is from The Onion, September 1949. A-bomb may have awakened gigantic radioactive monsters, experts say. Flying turtles, 200-foot moths among rumored creatures. Then there's another headline, hideous wooden imp causes national panic. And there's a picture of Howdy Doody there. Nightmarish puppet beast featured on children's show. Millions of youngsters lapse into fear-induced comas. And then down here, there's Bing Crosby record reveals secret message when played backward. And the message? Have a swell day, ladies and gents. Impressionable youths may fall victim to hidden suggestion. And then it, in the story, it goes on to say authorities are alarmed by an increased swellness among our nation's youth.
That's very good. Now, what you were too young to have grown up with this. What pop culture did you grow up with? What records? And
I had a weird music childhood. My mom was a pianist, and she only had classical music. And she had two pop records. She had John Denver and the Carpenters. And that's what I knew, you know. And then it wasn't until I was in my early teens that I discovered pop radio. And we started buying singles. And I had no idea there were such things as albums until I was in high school. And by then, I was kind of already an old man. And I was like, this kid's music. You know, it's all just, it's the same chords twice, you know. So let's see. I mean, besides music, I loved movies. I always went to movies. And I was pretty on top of that whole game. I read Mad Magazine as a real youngster.
Now, tell me if these reflect the era you grew up in. These are headlines. KTEL execs warn, we must stockpile solid gold 70s hits for the future. Hits to be sealed in the vault. Musical reserves will see U.S. through potential disco drought. Did you grow up with the KTEL ads?
Those are obviously from the 80s and 90s when they started packaging all those 70s hits and selling them. It actually was a really interesting experience doing this section of the book on the 70s because, you know, I lived through this time. And the big thing I remember from the 70s is Evel Knievel trying to jump the Snake River Canyon. That's like my biggest memory. And so, of course, we had to have a front page where President Ford promises to put a man on the other side of the Snake River Canyon by 1978 on a NASA, you know, NASA jet-powered sky cycle.
And here's another one I really like. Joe Piscopo, will his star ever stop rising?
See, that's one. I love those, like one of those knowledge of the future jokes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
There's no way you could make that joke now. You know?
Now tell me about this one. And this is a headline that marks the beginning of the baby boom generation. Toxic levels of self-involvement found in many post-war babies. 70% of infants' first word, me. Entire generation expected to be intolerable to parents, children, each other. Who came up with that one?
I can't remember whose specific idea that one was. But, you know, we all of us are, you know, in the so-called 20-something or Generation X. And so we grew up in the shadow of baby boomers who kind of dominated the culture and the agenda. And so we always enjoy taking little pot shots at the baby boomers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Dickers, the editor of The Onion. And there's now a book version called Our Dumb Century, which is a collection of Onion newspapers from throughout the 20th century. Have you gotten a lot of interesting responses from real political figures who you've had mock headlines about?
On occasion. It was funny because in the earlier years, before anyone really knew about us, and, you know, we labored in obscurity for about 7 years before people, you know, generally started to know of our existence at all, people who were famous, who we made fun of, would get really angry because they had no idea what we were. And they would say, who are these damn kids making fun of me? You know, they didn't know if we were serious or silly. But then once we got a little more known, the response completely changed. Suddenly it was a knowing wink, like, enjoyed, you know, being poked fun at. It's like now they're part of the national humor dialogue, and it's cool to be made fun of by The Onion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very, very strange. People ask us if we've ever gotten sued, and, well, no, because, you know, anyone who would sue a humor publication for making fun of them, you know, would just look like a complete square. President Clinton would never sue Saturday Night Live. You know, you made fun of me. It just is not going to happen.
Well, I'd like to close with the final entry in Our Dumb Century, and this is the year 2000 headlines. Would you read some of those for us?
Yeah. We, unlike a lot of the century retrospectives you'll read this year, we actually decided to just go ahead and and include material from the year 2000. And from January 1, 2000, the front page headline is Christian Wright Ascends to Heaven. And there's a picture of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Ralph Reed all following Jesus Christ up a golden staircase into heaven. And there's Planet Temporarily Closed Due to Computer Crash. And here's Could a Rich White Male Be Our Next President? Election Preview, page 6B. There's other little items like there's TV headlights, John Mellencamp's Slightly Rockin' New Year's Day Brunch on VH1. And there's a little weather map with a color-coded key that says there's a plague of locusts in this area, plague of toads in this area, and a plague of infomercials in this area. A lot of apocalypse humor in the year 2000. There's a little chart on the meteors headed for Earth today. And then there's the Dow Jones arrow. The four horsemen of the apocalypse swept through the New York Times Stock Exchange today, smiting thousands of wicked moneylenders and Jews.
Well, Scott Dickers, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Terry.
Scott Dickers is the editor of the satirical newspaper The Onion and the book version of The Onion, Our Dumb Century. Here's another news story from the audiobook version.
It's The Onion Radio News. I'm Doyle Redland. A six-legged frog with a human head held a swampside press conference Friday to warn of the dangers of tampering with the basic building blocks of human and animal life. Addressing top executives from the nation's leading genetic engineering firms, the mutant six-legged amphibian-human hybrid called for an immediate moratorium on interspecies DNA experimentation. According to the grotesque parody of nature, current standards of regulation within the $42 billion genetics industry are woefully inadequate and in need of immediate reform.
Please, I beg of you, my human half-brothers, do not create others like me.
Moments later, the frog was brained with a shovel by a frightened scientist as hundreds of horrified onlookers cried out for someone to kill it. For God's sake, kill it.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Life of Birds by David Attenborough, a companion to the 10-part TV series airing now on PBS, in bookstores or on the web at pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, satirical songs written and performed by Loudon Wainwright III.
A bunch of nerdy, brainy guys a long way back invent a crazy little thing they call a UNIVAC. For years now, they've been upgrading that thing. It can walk and talk and count and think, and it can even sing. It can help you at school, church, business, and work. Makes you feel like a genius, even though you're just a jerk. You get a computer, you sit it in your lap. It does a little bit of this, it does a whole lot of that. It can boot you up and look you down. With that little bitty mouse, you're gonna rule this town. But you head up for trouble, I do believe it's coming your way on New Year's Eve now. Whoa, whoa. Now,
Y2K!
No, it ain't a virus, it's just a little glitch. It wasn't done by some crazy hacking son of a bitch. And Saddam didn't do it, can't blame him. No, it's the geek with the glasses and the stupid silly pen. Billionaire Bill, that's the one you can hate. If you wanna blame someone, blame Bill Gates! Bill Gates! Bill Gates! Bill said we'd make money, Bill said we'd have fun. But remember how the computer in 2001? We're in a time machine, going back to my friend.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Clintons, Jesse Helms, and Y2K anxieties are some of the subjects Loudon Wainwright III satirizes on his new CD of topical songs, Social Studies. Several of the songs were written for and first performed on NPR's news show, Morning Edition. Wainwright has been recording since the 60s. He often writes acerbic lyrics about family relationships and middle age, which he sets to catchy melodies. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has called him one of the most entertaining and enlightening performers in contemporary music. Ken said, "Where other singers and songwriters tend to make themselves look good, or at least like sensitive souls who have learned from their mistakes, one great value of Wainwright's music is that he freely acknowledges what a screw-up he is, thereby allowing us to recognize what screw-ups we can be ourselves." Let's start with a track from Wainwright's new CD of topical songs. This is New Street People.
Trapped in skyscraper office space, take your break, escape in haste. I'd walk a mile for that great taste of my brand Ivy Sing. Standing there in pears and trees, chattering teeth and trembling knees. We French inhale and then we sneeze, and suddenly it's spring. So far you've had just two today. Baby, you've come a long, long way. Down 40 flights, what can I say? Just to get that hit. We stand around the helpless ones with the homeless, the winos, the bums. Reteach us how to suck our thumbs. Show us how to quit. Ostracized in restaurants, airplanes and public haunts. Deprived of our most cherished wants, that is to say the weed. We see the billboards and we long to live there, that's where we belong. Where looking cool is never wrong, and it's normal to need. We're the new street people. We're the ones you see.
Loudon Wainwright, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Good to have you back. Before we go any further, do you smoke, and do you smoke outside with the other new street people?
I don't smoke at the moment, or these days. I smoked for many, many years, and then stopped, and then I've had several slips. But I'm a recovering smoker, I guess you could say.
You dream about cigarettes?
Oh yeah, and anywhere where there's secondary smoke, you can find me there. I'll tell you.
Just inhaling deeply.
Yeah, I hope they don't outlaw that, because that's my only source of nicotine pleasure.
Do you let people smoke in your house?
Yeah, I invite them to. There's signs everywhere saying light up if you got them.
Loudon, over the years, a lot of us have heard your topical songs on NPR's Morning Edition. How did you start doing topical songs?
Well, about 10 years ago or so, my sister Teddy Wainwright, who was managing me at the time, had an idea that it might be fun to write topical songs and have them. So she got in touch with Tom Cole, who's the arts editor in D.C. for NPR, and pitched the idea to him of my being a regular musical contributor. And he thought it was a fine idea. So we've had this kind of back and forth situation where if Tom gets an idea, he'll call me and ask me to write about something, or if I get some idea, I'll call him, and that's the way it's really gone.
How do you like writing on commission? Like, say, your editor would call you and say, we need a song on people who have to smoke outside because they're not allowed to smoke indoors anymore. Do you like writing on somebody else's suggestion?
It's a good thing. The first thing is I panic, and, you know, if usually there's a deadline involved, and I go, oh, gosh. In the end, I like it, I seem to be able to do it. That is, you know, write to order and deadline. My dad was a journalist. He wrote for Life magazine for many years, and I think I might have, inherited that genetic thing where I can do that, you know, write to order and deadline.
Let's listen to another song from the CD. How about Inaugural Blues? Tell us what the occasion was, obviously the inauguration for the Clinton inauguration, first time around for writing this. But tell us more about what you were thinking at the time you actually wrote it, and if there were any other stipulations from NPR about what they wanted the focus of the song to be on.
Well, that was one of the ones where they had this thing. I don't know if folks remember, but in 19 for the first inaugural, there was a thing called Reunion on the Mall. It was a kind of a big party that they had on the mall, and there were several tents erected, and they had musical bands and singers and things, and they had invited me to come down and sing in one of the venues, and I thought I should write a song for the inaugural, it's a big occasion, and but I was having a problem coming up with anything, and it came to go down to Washington to do this thing, and I didn't have anything, so I thought, well, it's not going to happen. But the night I got down there, which was the eve of the inaugural, I was in the hotel room and was aware of the celebratory fireworks, which I could actually see and hear from my window, and at the same time I was watching television and kind of channel surfing, and I came upon CNN, and we had begun to bomb Baghdad that night. And it was that eerie kind of green picture on the television of this night bombing of Baghdad. And I just thought it was an interesting almost stereo effect of, the fireworks outside the window and the bombs on television. So that was an idea, and then I actually wrote the song that night and performed it the next morning with the lyrics kind of taped to the microphone. Very dramatic.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Loudon Wainwright, Inaugural Blues, from his CD, Social Studies.
Talking about my generation, people try to put us down, but they weren't people, just our parents. Now they're old or not around. Bill and Hiller, our first couple, student press, homecoming queen, Tipper's cute, Albert's handsome, the in crowd is the winning. Baby boomers are the bosses. Rock and roll is here to stay. Fleetwood Mac got back together in separate limos on reunion day. We got Elvis and the Beatles protesting. Now we've won. Bill's gone gray, Al slightly balding, but we are forever before.
That's Loudon Wainwright from his new CD, Social Studies. The last line of your song, Inaugural Blues, is hope we grow up before we grow old, which is obviously, you know, a play on the Whose Line, hope I die before I get old. I'm wondering how you felt about that line, hope I die before I get old, in its time.
Yeah, well, this is my generation. The song and it's the generation that I'm in. And we did think that we were we were going to be young forever, and God forbid that we should ever have to grow up. And at the time, I suppose, I was right along there with Pete Townsend. I mean, I didn't, you know, I wanted to live forever or die young, I suppose.
Do you feel like your feelings about your own generation have changed from the 60s to now? Are there things that you once felt kind of in solidarity with that you're now kind of embarrassed about?
Well, I was in Haight-Ashbury in the Summer of Love, and every time I see a clip from Monterey Pop, I really feel embarrassed about being there.
Why?
I don't know, because the clothes were so bad.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, but and now, of course, all that stuff is happening with Austin Powers and stuff. But I don't know. I always felt outside of everything. Maybe even at the time, you know, I wasn't doing a lot of marching. And my first album, which came out in 1969, I was wearing a Brooks Brothers shirt with gray flannel pants and had really short hair. I mean, I thought I wasn't really that. I didn't want to be with it. I mean, I wanted to be, I guess, different or something.
Different. Was the Brooks Brothers suit and the short haircut a sign of defiance?
Well, it was also the uniform of my adolescence. I went to boarding schools and grew up in northern Westchester County. And, so in a way, it was really who I was. And it occurred to me that would be, since nobody else was daring to look like that at that time, I thought that this might be a way to go. And in the beginning of one's career, you do kind of sit around and think, what can I do to stand out or be noticed? And I thought, well, why don't you be yourself? Which is this guy from Westchester, that's who I really was.
My guest is Loudon Wainwright. His new CD of topical songs is called Social Studies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. I guess the singer and songwriter Loudon Wainwright, his new CD of topical songs is called Social Studies. Let me get to another song from your CD. And this is one about phone sex. This is not one that was on NPR's Morning Edition, I take it?
No, they passed on this one. But I felt that, our president has revitalized the phone sex thing, I suppose.
I think it's a very funny song. So let's hear number one. That's what the song is called. This is by Loudon Wainwright from his new CD of topical songs called Social Studies.
Of all the chicks and broads and babes and bimbos I have known, no one does it better than you do on the phone. Midway through my busy day, all through my empty night, I dial your 900 number and it feels oh so right. When I'm feeling lonely and bottled up inside, I know I can always take that magic carpet ride. I get down on my bearskin rug on my living room floor. I get you on till I fall. Give me what for. When it comes to loving on a phone, you are the best. Local or long distance,
pickup bars.
That's Loudon Wainwright from his new CD of topical songs, which is called Social Studies. So this wasn't on Morning Edition. Who commissioned it, or was this one of your ideas?
I think I wrote it just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
Then it occurred to me that we could use it on the record because it's become, it's in the news again, or people are doing more of it or something.
Can you imagine having phone sex without just laughing hysterically at the absurdity of it? Maybe you can. Maybe it's just
part
me.
Of the, yeah. Well, let's try that. We're on the phone. I've had it once, and it was all right, but not enough to have it twice. Let's put it that way.
Did you have it once?
Sure did.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, Linda's gonna kill me. Oh dear.
Okay. Well, what I was thinking about was the kind where you actually pay and everything.
Oh, that I wouldn't do that.
Wouldn't do that.
I've never paid for any of that stuff. in any. No. Some people like to pay. I prefer to get anything and everything free.
Loudon, before you were talking about the Brooks Brothers outfit and the short hair that you mm-hmm. used to wear when you started performing, because that's who you really were. Who did you think you would be when you started in music?
I wasn't sure. I mean, I wanted to be huge, as they say. And of course, at the time, and I suppose still, the guy to beat was Bob Dylan, certainly. And in the late '60s, when I started to write songs and made my first album, Bob was kind of out of the picture. I think he was recovering from his motorcycle accident and was, wasn't performing and things. And he was the man to beat, I suppose. And sure enough, when I began, I was touted as a new Bob Dylan, along with every other guy who was any good who played the guitar at that time. You know, John Prine or Steve Forbert, or I think even Springsteen was called a new Bob Dylan. But I don't know if I wanted to be him. But
in fact, one of the songs you wrote for NPR was about
right
being one of the new Dylans.
Talking new Bob Dylan.
Yeah, you actually have. That's unfortunately not on the new CD, but you have your guitar with you. Could you do a little bit of that for us?
Hey, Bob Dylan, I wrote your song. Today's your birthday, if I'm not wrong. If I'm not mistaken, you're 50 today. How are you doing, Bob? What do you say? Well, it must have been about 62. I heard you on record and you were brand new, but some had some doubts about the way you sang, but the truth came through and loudly it rang. You were hipper than Mitch Miller and Johnny Mathis put together. So I got me some boots, a harmonica rack, a D21, and I was on the right track, but I didn't start writing until 68. It was too daunting. You were too great. But I won a whole lot of Bob Dylan imitation contests. The sun's not yellow, it's chicken. I can't remember any of it. Anything else?
That's very good.
Something along those lines.
In some ways, you know, you're really like Dylan's opposite, in the sense, lyrically, because he's so inscrutable and obtuse in his lyrics, and you're pretty just
crystal
emotionally...
clear.
Well, you're pretty emotionally direct and very personal, even though you're often writing in character. There are really interesting emotional, complex stories being told in your songs.
Yeah, there's nothing cryptic about it. Bob is, as you say, very mysterious and not always discernible.
Well, hiding behind language in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I am, on the other hand, I'm kind of like the guy with the raincoat, you know.
A lyrical flasher.
That's me all over.
My guest is Loudon Wainwright. His new CD of topical songs is called Social Studies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Loudon Wainwright. His new CD of topical songs is called Social Studies. We've heard some of the songs from your new CD. You have your guitar with yours, hoping maybe you could play for us a new song that you've done that hasn't yet been recorded, not necessarily a topical song, but just a new song of yours.
Here's a new song, more family material. Called White Winos. Mother liked a white wine when she was alive. She was desperate to live, but her limit was five. Carefully I'd kiss her, I'd send her off to bed. We always stuck with white wine, we stayed away from red. Always stick with white wine, stay away from mother. Liked her white wine, she'd have a glass or two almost every single night after her day was through. Sancerre, Chardonnay, Chablis, Pinot Grigio, just to take the edge off, just to get the glow. You've got to take the edge off if you wanna get the. Mother liked her white wine, she'd have a glass or three, and we'd sit out on the screen porch, white winos, mom and me. We'd talk about her childhood, recap my career. When we got to my father, that was when I switched to beer. We got to the old man and I'd always switch to mother. Liked her white wine, she'd have a glass or four, each empty bottle a dead soldier. The marriage was the war. When we blurred the edges, when we drank a lot, that's when I got nervous, when the glow got hot. I always get nervous when the glow gets. I still like my white wine and I'll have a glass or two. When I'm down, I'll drink some whiskey. It's something I shouldn't do. Every now and then I'll take a drop of red when I'm with a woman that I wanna take to bed. When I'm with a woman that I wanna take to. Mother liked her white wine when she was alive, and she was desperate to live, but her limit was five. Carefully I'd kiss her, I'd send her off to bed. Thank God we stuck to white wine and we stayed away from mother. Liked her white wine.
It's Loudon Wainwright. Loudon, that's a great song.
Thanks.
Tell me what you were thinking about when you wrote it. Like, why you think that song came to you when it did?
Well, let's see. My mother died 2 years ago, and I knew it was going to be a kind of a when it was going to happen. It was going to be heavy, and it was even heavier than I had imagined. So I was just that year I bought. I finally, you know, I've spent my whole adult life renting and living in apartments that I've rented and houses, summer houses. I wound up buying two houses that year: a house in the country and a house and an apartment in New York. And I'm sure it's had to do with trying to get home or something. And the house in the country had this screen porch, you know, and we used to sit out on other screen porches and drink white wine and do the things that, some of the things anyway, that I talk about in the song. So, I think, you know, that's kind of where that one came from.
There are probably things that you'd say in songs that you wouldn't have said when she was alive.
Yeah, I was wondering if she would have liked that song or would have said, oh, why, goodness, I wish you hadn't done that. But she was a bit of an exhibitionist herself. She she's mentioned in several of my songs, as are most of the key players in my life. I drag them all in there. And, I like to think that she'd like the song.
Loudon Wainwright, his new CD of topical songs is called Social Studies. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Kathy Wolf, with Alan Tu, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Lauren Krenzel. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
In the morning I read the paper. In the evening I watch the news. Sit there in my armchair, I stare, flip, switch, peruse the stories and the pictures. For me there's no escape. I read all about it, see it live, see it on tape. It's there in living color, plain in black and white. Things just go on happening. They go wrong, things aren't right.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publishers of War of the Rats by David L. Robbins, a novel about the World War II battle in Stalingrad, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we commemorate the centennial of Ernest Hemingway's birth with his friend and colleague A.E. Hotchner. A new edition of Hotchner's memoir about Hemingway has just been published. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.